This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Power Politics. I'm Jeronimo Cortina, Political Science and Associate Director at the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Houston.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor, also from the University of Houston, one floor down from my colleague Jeronimo. Interesting week this week. Obviously, we've got a big agenda. The debate happened. You were there. You saw some cool stuff, which you want to hear about. So it's a crazy week, so get out your white claws, right? Or maybe it's been a Four Loko week. I don't know. It's going to be fun. Let's start first with a 2020 update on a more humorous note, and that is a potential basketball game that is underway, at least as a challenge. So what is happening there?
Well, apparently Fox News showed a clip of Andrew Yang, who's one of the 10 or 15 Democrats running for the nomination, playing basketball a day before the debate that happened yesterday here in Houston, and they suddenly suggested a game. So
asterisk on that. It was an 8-foot hoop.
Right.
As opposed to the 10-foot regulation hoop.
Right.
So him dunking looks impressive, but only because of that context, right?
Well, I mean, I did a little bit of research because this is what we do.
That's what we do.
He's about my height.
Okay.
He's about 5'7", according to the social spheres.
Yeah, but with hops, though, right?
Right. And then, you know, Senator Cruz is about 5'11", so there's going to be a difference. But the funny thing is, Senator Cruz replied, like, with a gif from The Rock saying, bring it. And,
right,
you know, Cruz, he has that witty, dark, Baltimore type of style
energy.
Humor. And he said, you got to pull at least 5% or more to play on my court.
Yeah, okay.
And Andrew Yang responded, bring it. So
he's got the
5%. Might have one game.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, well, that's it. You know, well, everything left on the court, right? Yeah, they're going to do it for charity, which is great. In fact, we know Cruz did this when he faced off against Jimmy Kimmel. I think that Kimmel won, as I recall.
No, I think Cruz won.
Cruz won? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
So he's got a record, a winning record. You want to protect that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
Okay.
But, you know, it's going to be interesting. As you say, for charity, I'll even play Senator Cruz if he gives me the honor to play with him.
You know what's interesting is that this is kind of Cruz softening his image, right? He had this sort of, as you say, kind of the Voldemort style, you know, cape-draped sort of mentality. But he had a debate this week or a conversation this week with Alyssa Milano, which we talked about last week. And now Andrew Yang is, I think, going to sort of softening some of the Cruz image, which probably is good for him. But look, beard or no, he's no James Harden. So I don't know how he's going to fare against Andrew Yang, who seems like he's got a little game. So we'll keep a close eye on this.
Absolutely.
But speaking of keeping a close eye on things, Jeronimo, Congress is back in session. So what should we expect going forward for the next couple of weeks where they're back in working order?
Well, hopefully we would expect a little bit of more action in terms of gun control policies. Mm-hmm. You and I and Univision, we recently did a poll, and it's funny to see that, well, not funny, but it's alarming to see that a lot of people in Texas want basically gun control.
Yeah.
We're talking about big numbers in Texas. Around 90% of Latinos want some sort of control on background checks and red flag laws. Or even Republicans, 78% of those Republicans that we surveyed agreed that Congress should take action on background checks and red flag laws.
Yeah, and their time to do it's pretty limited, right? They've only got 13 days to actually work in September, and then they leave for a 2-week recess, and they only have 45 days left to legislate in the year. Keep in mind that the government's going to run out of money on September 30th, so they've got to have a deal before then. That's going to eat up a lot of bandwidth that I think, as you say, would otherwise go to something like gun control legislation. They've also got to deal with, you know, trade pact issues. They've got to deal with prescription drug questions and also impeachment, right? So there's a lot of stuff on the agenda, and I want to talk to you about that, but I think partly Congress is again, engaging in this kind of brinksmanship politics. And I think that they do so in part because either we are insensitive to it, we are used to it, or maybe we're addicted to it as the American people. But they're going to really, once again, be on a high wire act to get government funded. So that's going to be a very dicey outcome. But impeachment's the other kind of phase of this, right? So this week, the House Judiciary Committee voted to broaden the panel's powers to investigate President Trump. This is not a formal impeachment launch, but rather a kind of, I know I would say, kind of kitten steps towards making this happen. It's like, to me, did you see that movie, The Quiet Place, where the monster can hear things and is sensitive?
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
It's like that. Like, they're afraid if they make a move that's too loud, they're going to get pounced on. A bare majority of Democrats are backing this impeachment. This is potentially going to spell trouble for candidates like Lizzie Fletcher here in Houston, who are moderates who are going to have to take a stand. Mm-hmm. Impeachment, yes. Impeachment, no. So it's a kind of a really dicey situation for Nancy Pelosi to have to navigate.
Well, and this is the classic case, textbook case of semantics versus gymnastics versus flopping around, flip-flopping around.
Yeah.
But what's interesting here is looking towards, you know, 2020 and the primary, right? 72% of Democrats, or those who identify with the Democratic Party, wants to see President Trump impeached, while that number drops to 39% of independents. So I think the Democrats need to take a very clear position, because if 72% of your base says that they want you to do something, and you are flipping around and messing around the bushes and say, like, oh, it's not impeachment, it's an investigation.
Right.
But at the end, you can call it whatever you want.
whatever works on the ad, you know.
Exactly. It's going to be bad.
Yeah.
It's going to be bad. And, you know, Republicans, that number drops to around 8 or 9%. But Republicans usually do not vote for Democrats. So
yeah.
I think they have to take a clear stand.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
What's up with John Bolton, Ambassador John Bolton, and, you know, his fairly long, more than 17 months stay at the White House, and all these, like, you're fired. No, I quit. Oh, no, I fire you first. No, it was me who quit in the first place. So what's going on there?
Yeah, it's a soap opera, as usual, when somebody leaves the White House. But that aside, you're right. I mean, John Bolton's been a fixture in the White House for a while, not just the Trump White House, but also the Bush White House. And he, as you said, was abruptly forced to resign or quit or who knows what. His hawkish approach, I think, was Donald Trump's alter ego. That was his id. Now, Trump, to me, wants to talk like a hawk, but he acts like a dove and governs like a dove in foreign policy. And so that became a real problem for trying to get some movement, especially on the issue we're just talking about, the Taliban issue. The president wants to take peaceful steps and wants to take kind of modest movements and incremental approaches, but Bolton had different ideas. He wanted to go much bigger and have a much more aggressive stance. That wasn't what Trump wanted. And so there was obviously a disconnect, and so he had to go. Trump's foreign policy is big on ideas, right, that put America first, but short on strategy. So again, we don't know how he's going to get to where he wants to be. Ultimately, this empowers the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, if he chooses to stay and not run for Senate in Kansas. So that's something which is, I think, a different vibe. I think we'll have the president's view more clearly seen, as opposed to it being kind of modified through Bolton's eyes.
Right. But the question is, if you think that is going to affect, or his departure from the White House is going to affect Trump numbers with that particular wing of the Republican Party, those who are the hawkish foreign policy actors.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's, I think, precisely what the president is not sure of, right? They don't know what they want. And so as a result, they're getting nothing of what they want. And that's not uncommon for White Houses. Well, the president, of course, has been busy this week on Twitter, and he picked a Twitter fight with Chrissy Teigen, who's the husband of John Legend and who is an actress and New York Times best-selling author of some book I don't know about.
Yes, by her own right. I think it's a very successful woman. She's a model, a TV personality. She wrote a book, Eat Everything You Want to Eat or something like that, it was a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah.
And as you said, it's also the better half of John Legend, right?
Right. Okay. Well, so the crux of this debate was that apparently the president didn't like that John Legend and Chrissy Teigen, who were, you know, obviously celebrities, were taking credit for criminal justice reform. The president suggested he wasn't getting the credit he deserved, and other people were giving them too much credit for being involved.
Right.
So it was a little awkward, but you don't want to attack somebody who's got a Twitter personality like Chrissy Teigen, you're not going to win that. I saw somebody tweet out the following, that attacking Chrissy Teigen on Twitter was like invading Russia in winter. Like, it is not a smart move.
Right.
And what is it with conservatives now engaging with celebrities? It's like the new standing firm against warlords or something. Like, nice. They think that this is a way that they can demonstrate that, you know, they're tough and they're going to stand up to Hollywood or whatever. But it's becoming more of a thing. In fact, the Cruz thing we just talked about is part of that as well.
Well, yeah, but you see a different strategy, right? Chrissy Teigen came back hard at the president. And I mean,
we can't say what she said.
Oh, no. But I mean, and by all means, if you're called that by the president of the United States, what are you going to do?
Yeah, he called her foul-mouthed. Didn't name her in the tweet, but said that foul-mouthed wife of John Legend. So
right.
That's her.
And she came back just laughing and say, what a... tag everyone but me and honor Mr. President. And from there, it's fine.
Yeah.
Anyways, I don't even want to talk about this.
Right. It's another series of these Twitter fights, which becomes, news, at least briefly. But hey, let's talk Texas, and let's talk breaking news, because Senator Jose Rodriguez of El Paso has announced that he is not running for re-election to the Senate in 2020. He has been a member of the Senate since 2010. He is the caucus chair for the Democrats. This is an interesting departure. I mean, he was really the kind of guiding political force for the Senate in the last session, and I thought would be somebody who would be kind of a mainstay in standing up to Dan Patrick for the Democrats in the Senate. His departure probably leaves Senator Carol Alvarado here from Houston to replace him, at least temporarily. The replacement for him in the Senate could range from people that are local, their commissioners. You could also have potentially Cesar Blanco, who is a Democrat, maybe even Joe Moody, who's a Democrat there from El Paso too. Although Joe Moody, I think, has probably got a pretty strong career ahead of him in the House, and everybody seems to think that he's sort of speaker material, as it were. So it's an interesting dynamic, fast-moving story, so we're sort of breaking it as such, but an interesting development.
Yeah, indeed. And this begs the question of the institutional memory of the Democratic Party in the Texas Senate.
That's a great point, yeah.
What's going to do Carol Alvarado, a new senator? The last session was her first session. So it's going to be important, especially in looking at 2020. We're going to see different movements. So it's going to have an impact one way or the other.
Yeah.
Senator Rodriguez has all the right to say, I'm done.
Yeah.
But it is going to be an interesting dynamic looking towards 2020.
Yeah. And if the Democrats take control of the House, you're going to have divided government inside the legislative branch. And some members of the Senate are going to have to be working closely with the House and the Democratic side. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic, too, to see how that plays out.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, speaking of Dan Patrick, there's some news this week with respect to him and a long-term ally of him, the NRA.
Yeah. He went completely rogue on the NRA. I think it's great what he said. And basically what he said was openly supported the idea of changing the law and setting that universal background checks, especially transfers among private citizens or private persons, should have a universal background check if it is not done between friends and family members. So obviously this is a huge, huge, huge departure. The NRA hit back, and Patrick has not gave an inch on his remarks. And this obviously is, as we said before, this is an issue that really resonates with voters here in Texas, right? So I think it's a political move, but also I think Lieutenant Governor Patrick might be concerned about all these shootings happening in Texas.
Yeah, and I mean, even more perhaps than Greg Abbott, who had an easier walk to re-election in 2018 than Dan Patrick did. So Patrick definitely is in a position where politically he's in jeopardy. It's a part symbolic gesture, I think, but also part realization that this is a changing Texas and things have to move. It's potentially his Nixon to China moment. He recognizes that things have to be different, and this is perhaps that first step. And like you say, the public polling on this, which Dan Patrick actually said was part of the reason we need to think about this, is really changing. Republicans are softening. From October of 2017, 51% of Republicans say gun control policies should be left as they were. That's 48% now after the El Paso shootings.
Right.
We did a poll, as you mentioned earlier, with Univision, where we find that, in effect, that Texans support there to be background checks on all gun sales, red flag laws, and assault rifles banned. But Latinos in particular are much more likely to support that, 5-6 percentage points higher than the Texan average. So this is a set of policies that's likely going to happen in some way, shape, or form. And I think Dan Patrick's hoping to get out in front of it. Same is true for Greg Abbott, right? He came out literally days after with a set of legislative items that he thinks are likely to be something they should consider. So what do you take in terms of that dynamic, but also his specifics in terms of legislative priorities?
Well, he came out with he's short of what Dan Patrick is suggesting. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see because to me, this is some sort of kind of a realignment of the Republican Party in Texas.
Yeah.
It's moving away from that non-practical perspective or position. And he's trying to move to the center and be the party of we do things here.
Yeah.
End of story,
yeah.
Regardless of ideology. So Governor Abbott came out with 8 executive orders that recommended the legislature to consider ways to make it easy, affordable, to include these background checks in a voluntary manner.
Voluntarily is the key,
Exactly. So the people in Texas want something done.
The numbers are outstandingly high, right? Yeah.
And obviously, this is after he convened some roundtables with lawmakers, mm-hmm. community leaders, law enforcement officials, to discuss how to prevent future massacres.
Yeah.
So it's an ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. Democrats says, okay, it's a great first step, but the Democrats in the state are pushing for a special legislative session.
Yeah. Yeah. Can it wait, I guess, is the question. Like you say, these legislative priorities include things like considering prohibiting straw purchases, which is already illegal under federal law, but which would be sort of more enforced under state law, or expediting reporting of criminal convictions to the Department of Public Safety to try to close information gaps. These are ways to close loopholes or harden laws that have already been corroded, or empowering law enforcement, not directly related to guns exactly the way Dan Patrick said. So I think you make a good point there. To me, this actually corresponds more closely to what Republicans want to see done on gun control. So when asked who's most to blame for school shootings, poor parenting is the biggest factor, followed by the failure to identify potential shooters. So all the mental health stuff, all of the, you know, kind of hardening of criminal conviction stuff and the kind of early warning stuff is all, I think, politically suitable for what Greg Abbott wants to mm-hmm. do, which is why it's sort of tepid, I think, in context of the rest of what's happening. But in terms of the interplay between he and Dan Patrick, there's always been a kind of subtle power play between the two. They never directly challenge each other.
Yep.
It's never been that case. It's like Starsky and Hutch, right? There's a little rivalry, right? Like, who's going to get the collar on this one? But there's definitely, I think, enough here that we'll see this process kind of play out. But hey, speaking of inter-party battles, we've got an interesting one developing here. State Senator Pat Fallon from Prosper has announced he is exploring a primary challenge to John Cornyn. Geronimo, what does this mean for the Senate race and for the Republican Party?
Well, he says that it's the moment to perhaps present to the Texas voters a viable conservative choice.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that means, but I think
the people who know what it means, I think is what he's saying.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
It's like a nod, like a, you know, touch of the nose, right? Like,
right. But I think, you know, the person that should be thrilled about this is Senator Cornyn.
Yeah. Okay.
I think Senator Cornyn is like, oh, thank God that, you know, someone else is running against me in the primary. Because first of all, he has a ton of money.
Yes.
And second of all, the mood in the state is not anymore, in my humble opinion, towards those candidates that are very, very, very aligned, for example, with more conservative mm-hmm. issues, right? Mm-hmm. I think that the movement in the state is more to center, right of center. And if you look at the numbers of our poll, you see that Senator Cornyn has 41% voting intention. Okay. Caveat, we're 416 days away from the election.
Right.
But this is a good picture right mm-hmm. now, and it's a picture. It's not a prophecy or anything like that. I want to be very clear.
Right.
So I don't want to be blamed right. later. Like,
you said.
Oh, no, you said. No, I did not. Caveat, you know, asterisk, small print. So John Cornyn is polling right now among all Texas electorate at 41%, and the future, whoever Democrat candidate, right? Even though that they're not very well known in the state, he's polling around 40%.
Yeah.
So a challenger from the right to Cornyn might help him increase his numbers, given that he's running against someone that the people might not like.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I take a slightly different tact. I mean, I think that this is a serious enough challenge that Cornyn should be slightly worried. Cornyn is perhaps the least well-known Republican incumbent at the top of the ticket in 2 decades. In fact, our polling with Univision shows this. I think the ambiguity hurts him among conservative voters who don't necessarily know the conservative record. I mean, they might and they will after he advertises. But if the first thing they hear is a giant ad from Pat Fallon, who can self-finance because he did that in the Senate campaign, then I think it could be a problem for Cornyn. In 2014, Cornyn had a bevy of challengers, none of whom really caught fire, including Steve Stockman, who eventually ended up in jail. But Cornyn was held to under 60% in the primary, which gives you a sense that maybe things aren't quite where they are. And Senator Cornyn's kind of tactful approach is a great fit for the Senate, but is not the pugnacious kind of thing that conservatives want. So there's an appetite for that. Now, how much, I don't know. I'm like you. But the fact that Fallon announces that this, the Tea Party rally, the True Texas Project, formerly the Northeast Texas or Northeast Tarrant County Tea Party, shows that there's at least some support for that kind of an approach.
Yeah, but again, you know, 4 years ago, as they said, total, we ain't Kansas anymore, right? And Cornyn has, for example, 32% or 35% of women vote intention.
Yeah.
And, you know, white, non-Hispanic white women in the servers might be more likely to vote for a Republican candidate given, right, in the primary, given that they have other choice.
Yeah, I see.
That is an extreme choice that they certainly don't like, and we saw that in 2018.
So Cornyn hugs the middle and is able to, you know, in right of center Texas,
right,
compete. I can see that. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just, you know,
yeah,
educating you
just,
a little
just
bit
here
on
for the here for the knowledge.
Electoral politics.
I'm happy to have it, right?
Yeah, but again, small print. This is not a prediction. Or
sure,
like that.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the debate because you were there and you can give us some, again, up-to-date knowledge. There was no swearing, which is interesting. There was also a counter rally across the city from it to give Trump at least a little bit of an edge in the competitive Harris County. So what did you take from the debate? What are some top things that you thought were kind of relevant and that sort of made the scene?
Well, I think, first, let me tell you, when I arrived at Texas Southern University, which is our sister university in the same neighborhood, mm-hmm. I mean, it was hot. I mean, I walked and walked and kept sweating and sweating and sweating.
Right.
Carrying the laptop, the suit and everything. And then there was a plane circling Texas Southern saying socialists will kill Houston's economy. Right. But it
this was from the counter rally, the Vamos to Victory rally across the way from the city.
I love the name. But so I arrived there. The plane was making such a, I mean, it was very, 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 very noisy. So I passed the security checks and everything and got into the media filing center. And it's an impressive mm-hmm. operation. Certainly it's an impressive operation. The media is there. I could not finish counting how many people were there.
Mm.
I cannot count
that high,
that high in English, right? So, I mean, it was amazing to see. But, you know, in all seriousness, I think it was Vice President Biden did better in comparison to mm-hmm. other debates. He was more composed. He didn't messed up big time or anything like that, like he did the last debate. So he did better.
Yeah.
And there were also some attacks, no?
Yeah, he definitely took some arrows on that. On the counter rally issue, I want to talk about this because I find it just totally fascinating that like the Trump campaign would spend money to like have a plane fly overhead with a banner behind it.
Right.
Like this is spring break and you're advertising like dollar pina coladas,
right. Go to the cabana.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, come join us for $2 pina coladas.
Right.
The counter messaging just completely fell flat. Also because it's Houston. And like you say, it's hot. No one's outside watching banners from airplanes, right?
No.
In any case, too, our polling actually shows that Trump approval among Latinos is down to 24%, which is the lowest we've seen in at least since three or four cycles. So that, I think, alone suggests that there's a real sea change happening in Texas. And the Texans were kind of on display, right? I mean, we had Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke. I thought Castro, frankly, acted in a way that I'll use a language that you taught me, and that's like a burro, like swing wildly attacking Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. He tried to kill the king, but stabbed the curtain behind him instead. I think that it didn't play well. And, you know, you can be aggressive like that, but if you are otherwise the nicest person in North America and seen to be a kind of unifying candidate, as he's been through much of this, and then go on the attack, it's a potential problem.
Well, I mean, yeah, but also, you know, look what happened in 2016, right?
Yeah.
you know, the progressive, let's say, group of the Democrats, especially young people, they were not enthused about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
So they might see, or they see that in Joe Biden, right? They see the same old politics, same guys, just recycle. And they might see in Julian Castro, hey, you know, new blood. He's going after the old guard, right?
Yeah.
Could he have done it in a different way, perhaps?
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, Democrats are losing some of the battles because they don't realize that politics have changed.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we're not as we're, oh, hello, sir. Oh, yes, my dear sir. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, dear sir. And my good friend, the senator, my very, 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 very super good friend, the other senator.
Right. It's a nice way of saying, yeah.
Well, you know. You're in a competition, right?
Right.
This is an election.
Yeah.
Bring the knives out.
Right.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah, that's true. One person who didn't was Amy Klobuchar, who spoke in so many platitudes about unifying and the fact that we can't stand if we're divided. I think she's angling for a VP spot, which is actually not a bad play for somebody to do. But Beto, let's talk about Beto O'Rourke. To me, in this, he effectively lost Texas, the debate about the AR-15s. And he said, you know, hell yes, we're coming to take your AR-15s. I think this was a Hail Mary in a candidacy that's floundering a bit. How'd you read that?
I mean, maybe I'm not very sure that he's going to hurt him in Texas, as we saw, you know, the numbers or the mood in Texas is towards prohibiting those kind of weapons. But I think overall, he was the most clear and eloquent candidate on the stage that had a real position, very clear, very easily to understand in terms of what to do, a very clear buyback program. I'm going to take away these weapons that are weapons of war. I mean, not as clear as Andrew Yang saying, I'm going to give you $1,000. And I tried to get to the website, but...
It crashed.
It crashed. But, you know, that's what these debates need. Be clear in the message that you're delivering. When candidates start talking, for example, in terms of healthcare, about billions and these and that, and then another trillion, and then 50 million here, people lose track.
I agree. And I thought Elizabeth Warren did a good job kind of making it personal for people, where Bernie Sanders was defending like the nuts and bolts of it. And that's not going to be the way to really compel people. So I think that she won that interaction. And that was a pretty big one. And I thought for Joe Biden, you know, he was kind of stingy Uncle Joe, right? He said basically, you know, we can't pay for Bernie's healthcare plan and we have to follow the Constitution. And, you know, debt-free college can be a real problem. So I think that this is definitely showing the divides. This is the first time we're all on the same stage together. So we're seeing that liberal and moderate divide, and how that gets fought out is going to be, I think, the kind of next phase.
Right, right. And, you know, finally, I think it's, you know, Bernie Sanders, right?
Yeah.
Yelling. And once once he stops talking about healthcare, it doesn't make sense what he says in terms of the other things, right? And one thing that got my attention is that the economy was not mentioned.
Right.
It's like the big elephant in the room. It's like, don't mess with it. And I mean, it makes sense. The economy is doing, you know, okay.
Yeah.
There's the big R word that we don't want to mention.
Yeah.
But, you know, you cannot say anything about the economy because it's not going to play out well.
And where's the, you know, where's the congressional consent for this, right? Where's the congressional appetite for buybacks? Where's the congressional appetite for universal health care? Where's the for $1,000 per person freedom dividend? Congress is not going to go for that. So a lot of this is pie in the sky, but promises are to be made, and of course potentially down the road broken, right?
Yeah. So we'll see what happens next, and I think that's it for this week. So Party Politics is recorded here at the George P. Gary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall, who was up late watching the debate with us. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our stand-in audio engineer, Shannon Harrison.
Well, I'm Jeronimo Cortina.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. Until next week.